Welcome back. This is Primetime Sports on the Fan Radio Network, also Rogers Sportsnet and Sirius Radio as all. Gord Stellick checking in for the vacationing Bob McCowan, sitting in his seat for one day only. He'll be back tomorrow. Damian Cox looking at his BlackBerry. You can see that live on TV. And as well, sitting in the co-host chair, just filling the
radio
guys.
Just reading people's impressions of the job you're doing.
Oh, is that good? Okay. You got my Twix. Anyway, you got my tweet.
Twix. What is wrong with you?
Tweet. Well, what's wrong with you is I want to get to what we want to chat about later on a little
bit
of
baseball.
Did you
go up to the tennis on the weekend?
Didn't get a chance to. Watched a lot of it.
What does that
watched
mean, didn't you. Get a chance to? You're too cheap to buy tickets?
I really didn't get it. I was away on the weekend. Uh-huh. And maybe too cheap to buy tickets. No, I didn't get a chance to.
Remember the old days up at York with Du Maurier and all that?
Yep.
Imagine that. The cigarette companies.
It's one thing for curling.
Somebody was telling me the other day in the really old days, was it Players before Du Maurier?
I believe so.
And they actually literally would put cigarettes out in the press room.
Yeah.
For people. And one well-known Toronto reporter was known to go through and scoop them all into a bag and take more than his fair share home.
Well, it makes sense more with the curling when they had, I think it was exported McDonald's, and the guy smoked while they curled, and ashes would hit the ice. But
that's hard to do that when you play tennis.
Well, I think that was a while ago, and I know he had experience working for a brewery way back when, but now he's the CEO for Tennis Canada. Pleased to be joined by Michael Downey. How you doing, Michael?
I'm good, guys. How are you doing?
We're good. Do you remember those cigarette sponsorships way back when? Do we have it right?
I do, actually. I remember visiting as a fan, and they were great sponsors, actually, and helped build the tournament here in Toronto.
Well, Damian, of course, was in Montreal, so he saw some more from the men's side.
And Michael and I chatted.
And as well, the women's side in Toronto, it's the first year about, what do you say, the experiment, first year you've done it, that both go at once. It's a lot more tennis in 1 week. It's kind of less tennis, I guess, in 2 weeks when you used to have the tournaments back-to-back. What were your impressions of it? Is it something that's here to stay, or is there anything maybe you think could be tweaked?
Well, it is here to stay. This is the model that we will have moving forward, because the tours wanted the big events that hold the best weeks on the calendar to be combined. And so that's why we have this same week virtual combined model. I was quite pleased with it. I think overall we did quite well with it. The response from the fans tended to be positive. I think because we got rain in both Toronto and Montreal, we saw the benefits of a virtual combined TV broadcast, because when it was raining in Toronto, the fans across the country could watch Montreal live, and vice versa when it was raining in Montreal. So overall, I think we did quite well with it. The fans responded generally favorably. Change is sometimes hard for people to accept, but I think it's going to be a good model moving forward.
Now, you're 1 year into it, and next year you're going to have a bit of a challenge, because it's going to become right after the London Olympics, and already there's some suggestion that it may be difficult, depending on how some of these guys do and some of these women do, to get them to want to come to Toronto or Montreal right after London.
Yeah, we'll have our challenges. But, you know, we've been working on this issue for quite a while. I was thinking this morning about this, and it was about a year ago in November that I actually made my first presentation to the board of the ATP talking about the challenges we're going to face in 12 because of the Olympics. But, you know, it starts off with good news. And what I mean by that is that tennis will be in the forefront, because we'll have Wimbledon in July, and then 3 weeks later we'll have probably one of the best events of the Olympics, and that being tennis. And, you know, we had the chair of the ITF at our board meeting just this Sunday, and he was talking about how tennis is such a profile sport in the Olympics. So our fans are going to get a lot of tennis. That's going to help sell us some tickets, because we're in the news. And then we head the week after in Toronto and Montreal. So we will have our challenges, but we have some concessions that I think are really going to help us. The first being that both tours have given us a 48 draw. And what that means is normally the top 8 players get a first round bye. Now in both Montreal and Toronto, the top 16 players are going to get a bye. And that is really significant. There has never been in the history of a Masters Series event a 48 draw. And it really is attractive for the top players, because it obviously means they missed the first round and they can start later. And the second concession we got was something, quite frankly, that we've always been interested in, and that's a night final.
Right.
So we're going to go Sunday night with the men, and that's going to avoid the Olympic final, the Olympic closing ceremonies on TV. And then we're going to go Monday night in Montreal with the women. And our tournament is going to start a day later in Montreal and the women as well, which will help the ladies get to Montreal from the London game. So we think overall those are great concessions. And if I can go one step further, because we're part of a Masters Series event, and there's a very significant bonus pool that's for the top 12 players on the ATP side. And that pool has been increased effective for 12. So again, if a player misses Toronto, they sacrifice their bonus pool, and it is very significant. So we think all those things combined are going to leave us in good stead coming right after the Olympic Games.
So just so I understand, it actually doesn't come right after the Olympic Games. The tournament would be being held during the last week of the Olympics?
Yeah, so the Olympics are 2 weeks. The tennis event is the first week of the Olympics, ends that weekend, and our tournament start the following week. So we're in the second week of the Olympic Games.
So ideally, so they'd be, even the most successful players would be finished on the Sunday and theoretically available to get to Toronto or Montreal by Wednesday or even Thursday?
Yeah, actually, they should be able to get there earlier.
Right.
Okay. Our men's event will, if you have a first round bye, you don't have to start playing until Wednesday in Toronto. And if you're a first round bye on the women's side, you don't probably have to start until Thursday.
Now, Michael, you mentioned some pretty good concessions. What about the grassroots level? I know it's still a year away. Have you got any feedback from the players?
At the end of the day, they don't think that far out. And it's not surprising when you think of it, Djokovic is thinking Cincinnati now, and everyone else, including Novak, is thinking about the U.S. Open, which is 2 weeks away. There's no doubt the Olympics are important to them. It's a magnificent event. It only happens every 4 years, but they do really, really like the Toronto and Montreal events, and we've heard that time and time again because of the hosting that we provide and the amenities that we provide, and quite frankly, they're top tier events, especially on the men's side, being a master series.
Did you find this year in Toronto? I mean, I was in Montreal, and that's where you and I had a conversation. But Toronto, it seemed as though it didn't have quite the week they had in Montreal, and even at the end. The decision of Azarenka and Kirilenko to pull out of the women's doubles left people feeling a little bit shortchanged. I mean, can you understand that?
Yes, I can. And there's no doubt it was a bigger event in Montreal than Toronto. The numbers would say that. And we knew that going in. The first thing I'd say is historically, our Montreal event has been bigger. And we think a lot of that has to do with the sport's popularity. It's not that it's not popular in Toronto, but it is more popular in Montreal and Quebec. And our research sees that from both a participation end, a frequent player end, and an avid fan end. So it kind of carries through. If you've got more players and more fans in a market, you're probably going to sell more tickets. And that's historically what's happened in Montreal. And hey, at the end of the day, and I think Stacey would say this right now, the men's game is a little more popular. And it's because you've got these great rivalries going on between Joko and Nadal. And before that, it was Nadal and Federer, and I wouldn't count Federer out. And all those things have played to a bigger event in Montreal than we had here in Toronto. But I think we actually ended on a very positive note. Serena winning was very special, and I loved it personally because I believe we'll be part of that great story of her rebound after winning, after basically being out a year, then coming back and doing half decent at Wimbledon. I think she got to the third or fourth round, but that's not as far as she normally goes. Then to win Stanford 2 weeks ago, to win Toronto, now she goes on to Cincinnati, and she's going to go into the U.S. Open probably south of 30 in the rankings, and she's going to be the most feared player. And we got to see her in that final and quite frankly do very well in the final. So while the doubles final got canceled, unfortunately, because Azarenka had to pull out, we saw a great singles final, and we saw a great Legends weekend as well with Agassi and McEnroe and Courier and Chang, which added some great value.
Michael, actually, and John McEnroe, I guess, got hurt in one of those matches as well, even in the seniors. tour part. But I like that element. You talk about some of the injuries. I'm wondering now more and more, do tennis players pull out a lot easier? I mean, do you even as a, you know, kind of an organizer, do you tend to roll your eyes sometime? Is that kind of crept into the game a little more than it should be?
You know, I don't think so. It's a really tough schedule. And, you know, the critics will say that there's too much tennis still, even though both tours have shrunk the schedule. So there's a 3 or 4 or 5 week off season starting in mid-November, and that didn't even exist a year or two ago. But it is a long season that takes them to all the continents. And, you know, if you're a top player, you're playing 20-odd events and you're going deep at each one of them, that's an awful lot of tennis. So, you know, it does wear. But I generally think, especially in the WTA side, we've seen a significant improvement. Like, if I go back to when I started in 2004 in Tennis Canada, it was a very topical issue that we faced every time with the women's tournament. And quite frankly, it's really improved because they have shortened the season, and they've also they've reduced the number of major tournaments that we expect, that the top players are expected to play, and I think it's paid dividends.
Is it possible to assess at all what a top Canadian, somebody who could get to the quarterfinals or beyond, in either the men or women, would do commercially to these tournaments?
Oh, well, you know, when we talked about the Olympic challenge next year, I forgot to mention that Milos is coming back to Toronto. And what rank will Milos have when he plays in the Toronto Rogers Cup? And this will be the first Rogers Cup he will have competed in when he's defined as an elite player, because the last time he played Toronto, he was about 180 in the world. And the last time I looked, I think he's 28 in the world. So he's going to make an enormous impact on our tournament in Toronto next year, having this young star come back and play in his hometown in front of a home crowd. The overall answer is quite significant. When you think of it, we have two terrific tennis tournaments. Worldwide, Toronto and Montreal are extremely well-regarded. I mean that so sincerely, that's what we hear all the time. But one of the things that actually I've always been told by both tours is, it's amazing. You guys have these phenomenal tournaments, and you've built them without a top 10 singles player. And that is very unique, that most of the tournaments around the world tend to benefit from the local star coming back, whether it's Rafa coming into Barcelona or Madrid, the U.S. players like Fish and Roddick playing in Cincinnati this week, that's going to help them. So if we can see Milos get the top 10, Rebecca Marino get the top 10 or top 20 and going deep in the tournament, it's going to drive ticket sales from a walk-up basis. But I think even more so, it's going to drive our domestic TV ratings. Because if I go back a few years ago, we had a great run in Montreal when Stephanie Dubois and Alex Wozniak, I think, got to the third round in Montreal. And I remember those TV ratings on Tuesday and Wednesday were some of the highest we ever got. And it's because the domestic audience was following these young French-Canadian stars.
Michael, congratulations. A great week in two venues. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Michael Downey's the CEO of Tennis Canada. Gord Stellick, Damian Cox with you on Primetime Sports. Now, you were there. You mentioned, first of all, the buzz about Montreal versus Toronto, that they're, whether the men or women are in Montreal, is it a better vibe, a different vibe?
Well, the sense seems to be the best pairing is if the women are in Montreal and the men are in Toronto, because Toronto doesn't seem to get quite as excited for the women as Montreal does. And the women's tour right now is struggling. I mean, for star power point of view, it was good news that Serena Williams was able to come in and supply that this year. And that made a difference. But, I mean, you've got a number one player in Caroline Wozniak, who's never won a major. You've got a lot of players from Eastern Europe who don't necessarily have the kind of charisma or star power that some of these other, you know, the players like Henin and Maresmo and Davenport and all these, you know, well-known players used to have, and they all kind of left very close to one another. I mean, that was one of the big problems for the women's tour. They lost 5, 6, 7 really good players all back to back to back. In Montreal, on the other hand, with the men, I'd argue you're into a golden era of tennis. I mean, and you and I know, we can go back to the 70s and the 80s, but now with these three guys, Federer, Nadal and now Djokovic, who is better than both of them right now. I mean, you can sell that ticket anyway, anywhere. And I'll tell you, I had a couple of chances to sit four rows up in a friend's seats and watch a couple of the matches. Djokovic, first I saw Federer and Tsonga, then Djokovic and Tsonga, and it's phenomenal what these guys are actually doing out there on the court.
And a nice piece on Milos, and that's the wild card that this guy, when you ask people who are in the know, like yourself, about when there's been a male singles player like this, with this kind of potential, and right off the bat they say never.
No, I mean, there was always hope. And, you know, we remember sitting back and watching, well, certainly for the men. I mean, I guess Carling Bassett was once upon a time a hopeful player. But the men, I mean, we had Mitch Abada and Connell and those guys and Nestor briefly before he started concentrating on doubles. But, I mean, the possibilities that open up if Raonic turns out to be a legitimate top 20, top whatever player are, I mean, they're enormous. I mean, they really are. And we'll see. I mean, the hip injury is a concern. I think hip injuries are a problem for tennis players. Leighton Hewitt was one of the guys to get it. Tommy Haas basically had his career all but ended, it seems, by hip injury. But to get it this young is a bit different. And now we'll see if he's ready for the U.S. Open and also the Davis Cup next month in Israel. And right now, Raonic is hurt. Philip Bester, who won the clinching match against Ecuador in the last Davis Cup, he's got a fractured hand from playing, broke his hand playing. And Peter Polanski as well is still hurt. So there's some dicey issues for Canada into that Davis Cup. So those are the things, whether it's the Davis Cup or Raonic getting deep into tournaments, that start to generate the kind of interest that help you, that what I think would always have this, would do this tournament a lot of good. And I think Michael makes a good point. I mean, Canada's the one country in the world that goes into these events. They don't have any big time players. And then to have Raonic be hurt this year was too bad.
Well, big week done now for the Rogers Cup. We're talking, I don't know if it'll be all Canadian baseball, but Brett Laurie fever, because we're going to talk about that, what's going on around Major League Baseball as well. Joe Morosi, a national baseball writer of Fox Sports, is going to join us also later on.
Actually, it's John Paul Morosi.
John Paul Morosi.
Well, you can call him Joe.
I will. From Fox Sports, going to join us as well. And later on, Jim Popp, who is the general manager.
Can you not read?
Of the Montreal Alouettes.
Is that your problem? You can't read?
I can read. I wear glasses from far away, but I can see that John Paul Morosi.
Popp is the coach.
I said Popp's the general manager.
John Paul.
I know.
John Paul.
Jim Popp, general manager.
There you go.
He's the guy you wanted to get.
Oh, I love Jim Popp. I think he's interesting.
He's always somewhere mysterious. And
he gets players. He's like Mike McCarthy used to be, right?
That's right. Where's Mike McCarthy? He's not in Hamilton still, is he? He was great at getting players that way.
And Tillman's obviously a guy who's been able to do that kind of stuff. But Jim Popp's run in Montreal has been amazing. And it's obviously twinned with having Anthony Calvillo as his quarterback every week.
Well, some baseball chat when we come back. Gord Stelick, Damian Cox, you're listening to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet Radio as the Fan Radio Network. And you're watching on Rogers Sportsnet, listening on Sirius Radio. Welcome back. Primetime Sports. Gord Stelick in for Bob Macau, and he's going to return tomorrow. Damian Cox here, our co-host, as we talked a little tennis with Michael Downey earlier, CEO of Tennis Canada. We'll talk a little football later on. Jim Popp is the general manager of the Montreal Alouettes. We're going to talk a little baseball, not just Blue Jay baseball, but all that's going on around Major League Baseball, getting some playoff races, some pennant races going. A trade.
Hey, we got a trade today.
I know.
That's what I love about the baseball trade deadline. It's not really a deadline.
It just kind of gets, I don't know, watered down or a little more difficult. And joining us is John Paul Morosi, national baseball writer for Fox Sports. How are you doing today, John Paul?
Very good, gentlemen. I just hope I don't have to explain the whole waiver process. It's always such a fun thing we'd waste the whole segment. So we'll just jump right into the trade, right?
Yeah, we're not going to make you do that, but we will make you explain the infield fly rule at some point today.
Sounds good. I promise.
All right.
Well, we do know here, having seen Randy Myers go, that it could be a bit of a poker game years ago that you can gamble a bit. Someone will claim him. But obviously, in this case, the Tigers, Minnesota Twins, explain the trade and why a guy like Delmon Young is able to go through waivers.
Well, Dell Mignon was making close to $6 million this year, so basically about $1 million a month, and I think the Twins have fallen out of the race really in the 2 weeks since the trade deadline. They're certainly in much more of a sell mode than they were at July 31st, which is the non-waiver trade deadline, of course. And so they put Dell Mignon out on waivers. The Tigers claimed him. And in that 48-hour window, they were able to work out a deal where the Tigers sent a couple prospects their way. And I think he'll help the Tigers. An outfield bat will likely play a lot of left field for them. Really what this means in Detroit is Maglio Ordonez's time is kind of coming, I think, to an end in terms of his status as an everyday player or even kind of a semi-regular player. So he's on the bench now. Dell Mignon is in left field, and the Tigers, I think, did get better here in the short term.
Well, and Ordonez, as you said, his number's way down. But Dell Mignon's numbers are down, too. He had 21 homers and 112 RBIs last year. This year, nothing even close to that.
Yeah, Damien, it's been kind of mystifying, I think, certainly for the Twins and now for the Tigers to try to figure out why that has been. Really, towards the end of last season, he was an MVP-type candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think Tiger fans might wonder if they would have gotten even more production if they had just held on to Casper Wells, who they sent away to Seattle in the trade for Doug Fister. So I think that the Tigers are just looking to do what they can to get a little more production, just hoping that maybe he catches a little bit of lightning in a bottle here. He has had a good OPS above 800 in the month of August, so perhaps the Tigers are hoping they're getting him when his stock is rising again.
Boy, it's amazing when you think about it, John Paul, that with the Tigers, they're on top of their division. They've had Ordonez be relatively unproductive. They had the Brandon Inge situation where he's now out of there as well. And yet they've been able to find ways to find some other people to do some things for them.
Well, Damon, I think a real key thing for them has been Victor Martinez, getting him as really a guy to ride shotgun with Miguel Cabrera there as the big two bats in the middle of the lineup. And the rest of the guys, I think you're right, has kind of run hot and cold at different times. Austin Jackson has kind of been in and out as the leadoff guy. Brendan Bosch has really had a good impact. Also, Johnny Peralta and Alex Avila have given them a lot of RBIs down in the lineup. So what they really have now is it the best lineup in the American League? No, but it's a balanced lineup that I think has threats up and down, and I think that's been a key thing for them. And, of course, on the pitching side, they have Justin Verlander, and I think that he's been a real tone setter for that team. I think he really, as good as Miguel Cabrera's numbers are, he's probably their best MVP candidate. He's been terrific. He's affected so many games because he just eats up so many innings and eats up quality innings, obviously, with the no-hitter and a lot of other outstanding performances. So they've done it with very good pitching from Verlander in the back end the bullpen, and I think in a very, I don't know if I say mediocre, but I guess I probably will, a very mediocre AL Central, it should be enough for them to win the division.
John Paul Morosi is joining us. He's a national baseball writer for Fox Sports, and, you know, interesting streaks, and you talk, one came to an end yesterday, Dan Uggla, guy that was batting, what, 170 or whatever it may be, something incredibly low. You think of baseball records being guys like Joe DiMaggio or, you know, people like that.
What did he end up at, 33 games?
33 games, and a great defensive play that helped help stop it. And I'm curious, is this one of the more interesting ones you've ever seen? Because, I mean, he doubtfully would have hit 300 even if he carried on the streak for a while.
300? No. He wasn't going to hit 200 for a while there.
I know.
I mean, this guy was hitting well under, he was hitting under 200 on July 26th. There you go.
Wow.
Less than a month ago, he was hitting under 200, and here he goes with the streak. I mean, if there was an award for comeback player of the year within the year, I think Dan Uggla would probably have wrapped it up by now. But really, I guess the one thing you can say is this. You know, so often as baseball fans, we hear the explanation from managers or players like, hey, be patient. This guy's got a track record. Okay, well, Dan Uggla's track record said he's about a 250, 260, 270 hitter. Well, by gosh, he might get up into that area because he's getting all the hits back that the baseball gods had kind of stolen from him in April and May. So maybe there really is something to those great baseball bromides, guys, about how it all evens out in the end.
It's funny. I was down in Lansing, Michigan a couple of weeks ago with the Lansing, or seeing the Lansing Lugnuts play it, and asked a couple of people, who was the biggest name ever to come through here? And they mentioned a couple of different guys. And they mentioned Carlos Zambrano, who was one guy who was there briefly when they were a Cubs farm team, and I don't think he was with the Cubs. Well, anyways, but he was there briefly, and now all these years later, you see him in one of the messier situations. I can't remember, and you probably can, a player being suspended by his team 30 days for leaving his team in the middle of a game and packing up and saying he might retire, and then rethinking, maybe I don't want to do that. What is the future for the Cubs and Carlos Zambrano.
Well, it's a very, very tough situation there, Damian, as you illustrated. I mean, this is a guy that they invested $91.5 million in. And as
wow.
I said at FoxSports.com today, the Cubs have unfortunately made a habit of investing big dollars in the wrong people. They spent heavily on Milton Bradley, $30 million. And
another hothead.
Similar situation.
Yep.
It was not quite like you described, Damian, but it was similar in terms of they sent him home before the end of the season. It was late September. They just suspended him, told him, Milton, go home. We've kind of had enough. So, unfortunately, they've gone big with the wrong players, and I think that's why they really haven't had a franchise player going back to Sammy Sosa, which is one of the reasons why their drought has continued. I mean, this is a really complicated mess. He's got more money coming, more years.
How many more years does he have, John?
Point Paul? With him, and if I had to guess, I think he's probably thrown his last pitch for the Cubs this season. But, you know, you're almost tempted to say for good because they've gone down this road with him so many times, anger management, counseling, the whole works, and it just has not worked. And at some point, Zambrano's got to be responsible for his actions.
Well, I guess the one thing about baseball is you can still trade a guy and take some of the money.
Sure.
So that may be the way for them to move him. How many years has he got left?
I believe it's two more after this season, so it's not an insignificant amount of money. I mean, there is a lot of money still left, and because he signed the extension after it was during the 2007 season, so it was a multi-year deal, and he still got some time left on it. And I think it's going to be tough for them to find somebody to take on the full contract, certainly. But as you said, Damian, they might be able to eat some money, get that contract down a little bit to the point that it's palatable for another team.
Well, you know, you mentioned the 30-day suspension. In baseball, all we know about is the Players Association. They appeal every suspension regardless. I'm just wondering what kind of teeth do the Cubs have? The fact he quit, I mean, does this give a little bit of bite? Otherwise, it continues to make a mockery if guys are able to basically get everything overturned.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, there is a pretty healthy appeal process in baseball, certainly for the on-field discipline, but you're right. I mean, there are some concerns here with the fact that he left the team in the middle of the game. I mean, it's he also has a history of having to, you know, all the stuff is documented about the incidents in the past where he was suspended for going irate on Derek Lee in the dugout. I mean, this guy has a pretty thick discipline folder in the principal's office, so to speak. So I think that might work against him here, but it's my understanding, based on what was said earlier today, that there will be a grievance on file by the end of the day today, and we'll see where it goes. But you know, at the very least, he's not going to be throwing a pitch to them anytime soon. I mean, even if the suspension wraps up earlier than 30 days, it will be a couple weeks at least. And by then, the Cubs, I'm sure, would hope they can get him out on waivers and maybe get him through, certainly get him through, and then maybe move him to another team.
So you have this theory about the Blue Jays and the Mariners.
Yeah, I do. I wrote at FoxSports.com today. I said the Jays and Mariners are playing in Seattle tonight. In my opinion, they should be playing in Vancouver. They should be playing a BC place, I think, once a year. So if they play three times, then maybe one team has to forfeit a home series. They play out in British Columbia, that beautiful city, and let the fans in Western Canada get a chance to see Brett Lowry and their Jays, who, as we know, are now Canada's one national team. So I think it makes a lot of sense. Of course, the question is, and I really haven't gotten a firm answer on this from the folks at BC Place, maybe you guys have, if the scoreboard and the various stadium configurations for soccer and for the CFL would in any way preclude the stadium from being reshaped into a baseball diamond. And I would imagine that there was enough money in it that they would probably do anything. But I think that if it's doable from a stadium standpoint, they should try to do it every year.
Now, do you think there's the interest in Vancouver? I know Brett Lowry is certainly getting some interest there. But do you think, Brett, in Vancouver, they embrace the Jays as Canada's team?
Well, you guys might have a better feeling on that than I would. But, you know, I talked to Bart Given, as you know, the former GM, assistant GM of the Jays, who now works out in Vancouver. And he thinks for a one-time deal, you know, if you do it at the right time, you'd probably kind of have to hit the sweet spot between kind of the end of the Cup Finals and before the CFL really gets going. So maybe you could capture some attention there out there. I mean, I think that certainly for a one-shot deal, given the amount of fans, and I know I worked in Seattle briefly, and I covered games in Seattle where the Jays were there, and there would definitely be a healthy amount of Jays fans that would make the drive and cross the border. So I think, especially as long as Lowry is a big-time marketable player for that team, I think that it would be great. And, hey, try it for a year, try it for 2 years. If it works, great. If it doesn't, then maybe you move on. But I think at a time when Major League Baseball is trying to embrace their international element, I think they shouldn't overlook, to me, a slam dunk international opportunity there with the U.S.'s neighbors to the north and get a couple more games up in Canada.
Late in the season, you often see players get an opportunity like Brett Lowry's getting with the Blue Jays. They would have liked to have had him up earlier, obviously, but it turns out he arrives in August and is making quite the splash. Anybody else right now? I mean, having that kind of impact since I'm trying to remember the name of the young guy, the big hitter, the big outfielder in or first baseman, I guess, in Arizona, who came up after they made a couple of moves. But is there anybody else, any young players who have come up late in the season or are having the kind of impact we're seeing with Brett Laurie?
I think Brett Laurie's his impact so far is on a limited scope here in the 10 or so games he's played has been terrific. I think, you know, he's been maybe the biggest impact rookie so far, and if he had come up earlier in the season, he might be very much in the discussion for AL Rookie of the Year. I would say this. One kind of interesting possibility, Trevor Bauer, a very high first-round pick from UCLA, chosen by the Arizona Diamondbacks, would not surprise me at all, guys, if he ends up making a cameo, more than a cameo, in fact, with the Diamondbacks this year because they just lost Jason Marquis, who was their big trade deadline acquisition, to a broken bone in his leg. So they may need some starts there, and Bauer has very much a Tim Lincecum delivery, Tim Lincecum philosophy. Lee Jenkins, my friend with Sports Illustrated, wrote a great story on him in the most recent SI issue, so I would encourage you to check that out if you haven't yet. But it's an interesting philosophy that he has, and Bauer could be an impact guy for Arizona down the stretch.
Any updates, by the way, before we let you go on Steven Strasburg?
He's been throwing rehab starts, guys, and actually it's not out of the question. He could be back with the Nationals in September, so stay tuned there. The big sensation could be back, but right now it appears all systems are going on his recovery from Tommy John surgery.
Well, John Paul, lots of information, lots of great stuff. Thanks very much, as always.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you again soon.
John Paul Morosi, national baseball writer for Fox Sports, talking about, I think Brett Laurie is, you get a little biased when you're a Toronto Blue Jay or Toronto Blue Jay fan or observer or watcher, but there really hasn't been many of those guys around the league this year.
No, and again, you know, we probably would have been talking about this a month ago if he hadn't broken his hand when he was hit by a pitch. So I guess they've been thinking he was going to be there, and there are contractual reasons, I think, why they didn't want to start him in the major leagues this season. But, you know, it's exciting, and it's a long season. They've been around 500 all year long. Obviously, they're not going to make the postseason. Lots of youth, but then to add a guy with that kind of energy who makes you that kind of, you know, it really gives you a very much different look, particularly when you contrast him with, you know, the center fielder, Colby Rasmus, who's not that kind of guy. He's more of a laid back kind of guy. And so when you have a Laurie who, I mean, the last guy they had who played like that in my mind was Reed Johnson, you know, who could have that kind of, you know, excitement just by the hustle. Mm-hmm. And Laurie's obviously, you know, he's got a lot more pop in his bat. And, you know, I mean, he may be the first really legitimate Canadian big-time player the Blue Jays have ever had.
Well, you don't want a guy to get hurt. But, you know, in a lot of ways, how well he came back from that injury is also encouraging. Because quite often that's the death knell for a lot of guys, that first injury trying to bounce back. We're going to talk some CFL football. Bounce that way to Montreal. Jim Popp, the general manager, will join us. It's Gord Stellick, Damian Cox. You're listening to Primetime Sports on the Fan Radio Network, watching on Rogers Sportsnet, or listening on Sirius 157. You're listening to Primetime Sports, watching on Rogers Sportsnet, listening on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590, or Sirius Station 157. Gord Stellick, Damian Cox. And you talk about the dean, the architect of what it takes to win football consistently and for many years in the Canadian Football League. Pleased to be joined by Jim Popp, the general manager of the Montreal Alouettes. How you doing, Jim?
Good, Gordon, Damian. Nice. Doing good.
Well, that's good. We hear you're in Tampa. We always think you're someplace like Slippery Rock, uncovering that next jewel out there. So Tampa ain't Slippery Rock. What exactly are you doing in Tampa?
I am presently at the Bucks camp as we speak at practice. So I'm taking a break over here in the corner so they don't see me talking on the phone.
Now, I guess basically, Jim, it's just 12 months a year looking for football players.
It is. It's a nonstop job. Other than fan going and watching the games on game day and coming out to the stadium supporting all of us, it's a lot of work. It's the coaches, the players. They're training all year long. They're prepping players and us on the scouting and hunting talent down, not only for this year, but years to come. So it's a nonstop job.
Now, the NFL teams like Tampa, so obviously you go there with their blessing. Do they know you're there? You're there to look at guys that they're going to be cutting? Or what is the process?
Yeah, what people don't realize is the relationship we have with the NFL. The NFL and the CFL, all we ever do is exchange players. They're out trying to find the 22, 23, 24-year-old in our league, bring them down, and we're taking guys that played 3 years in the NFL that will never get their pension. You know, but people don't realize it's 3 years and three games, guys get their pension. And a lot of guys never get their pension, so those guys are looking for jobs. A lot of those guys come to the CFL. We're actually getting a great product of players that are better than some of the guys playing in the NFL, and everybody always wants to compare leagues. The leagues are different, but we do have players playing in our league that are better than guys playing in the NFL.
Now, with the Buffalo Bills today cut Aaron Maben, their first-round pick from a couple years ago, and big news in Buffalo, obviously. Now, you would think, I would imagine, that another NFL team would bring him in and have a look at him. Or because of him and because of his size, is he a guy that at some point would do exactly what you're talking about and be looking north?
Well, but the problem with a first-round pick, unless he just loves football and wants to play, is that he's got a lot more money than most guys that come to the NFL. I mean, once you venture off into a fourth, fifth, sixth-round pick, seventh-round pick onto a free agent, you're not making near the money a first-rounder does. So a lot of those guys that get first-round money are taken care of for a long time, and their desire to play anymore if they're not playing in the NFL really isn't there. So that's a rarity. But I'm sure he'll get looked at by other NFL teams.
Well, unusual for the Montreal Alouettes to lose two games in a row. I guess the good part is a bit of a test, and then you bounce back with two in a row of your own. What was the change in moving from the L column to the W column for you?
It's just playing better football. I mean, you got to give credit to the teams that beat us. I can't speak for them. I don't know how well they played, but from our end, we didn't feel like we played very well for a couple games. And then what happens is that you have too many penalties at the wrong time. You have turnovers, just not playing well-rounded football in all three phases. And we just didn't do that for those two games. The last two games, we've cleaned that up quite a bit. The great thing is they were correctable problems, and Coach Trussman and the crew and the players paid attention to detail and corrected those problems and went out and played much better football games the last 2 weeks.
You guys have been riding high atop the CFL East for a long time, and there have been many years where there hasn't been, I wouldn't say competition, but teams haven't been able to be consistent and put together winning records in the CFL East for a while. Now you've got, well, Winnipeg have off to a tremendous start, Hamilton with a winning record. In a way, does that help you in that it pushes your team a bit, that gives you that competition level to get you sharp earlier in the season?
Well, what I can say to that is every week when you're one of the top teams in the league, you're challenged. It doesn't matter whether you're playing in the East and West. Everybody gets up for you. And that probably keeps your team battle tested, especially when you get to the playoffs. So we've been experiencing that for a while. The other thing I want to point out is, you know, everybody gets caught up in the East and West, and the thing is that we've been extremely competitive in both divisions and had a winning record against every team we played over the last decade. So it really doesn't matter which division you're in. It is true that, you know, what happens is what has happened for us is we've been able to lock up our division earlier than normal, than most teams, and it's given us an advantage to even rest some people down the stretch. So right now, you know, we're behind people. We're trying to get back caught up there and stay with Winnipeg, and Hamilton's already beat us, and they're at our heels, and we've got to do everything we can to stay in the running to try to win our division again.
Only got about 30 seconds here, Jim, and I know this is a question you've asked, but now that you've seen him play for a number of games, how confident were you that Brandon Whitaker was going to be able to step in and fill the hole, that you were going to be able to let Avon Coburn go and Whitaker would be able to fill that?
Well, I mean, Brandon did a great job when we called on him in the past. He just hasn't played a lot in the three previous years. It's just simply we weren't sure what he could do from game to game to game. And he has proven what you're seeing right now is how he was in college. And, you know, 3 years later when he hasn't been doing it at a pro level, you're not sure if he can maintain adapting each week, doing what he has to stay healthy. And so far, so good. He's done remarkable. We're extremely happy for him. And we're very happy for Avon. You know, he's doing well down in Hamilton also.
Jim, we don't want you to run down like Joe Paterno did on the practice field a couple of weeks ago, so we'll let you get back to it. Thanks very much for your time. Continued good luck.
Guys, thanks for all your support to our league. Anytime you need anybody to talk to, I'll be happy to.
Thanks. Jim Popp, general manager of the Montreal Alouettes.
I love talking to Jim Popp.
I know, but wish him good luck. He's about the last. Wish me good luck and you good luck. Boy,
he's been in a. I mean, Anthony Calvillo gets a lot of the credit. They've done a lot of things, but Jim Popp is one of the constants there in Montreal.
Well, that's it. Gord Stellick, Damian Cox saying good night from Toronto.